So thank you for coming. My name is Fred Beattie. Just a bit of story. I'm a United Methodist pastor. I'm a member of the South Georgia Conference, grew up in the Deep South. I presently teach Christian education and faith formation at Duke Divinity School and have a long association with Duke's Youth Academy for Christian Formation, which I'll tell you more about as we go along. And so this is a conversation and not a monologue. And I'm starting to believe I went to the new people orientation yesterday, and everybody kept saying, there'll be people here you know that are already your friends, and then a bunch of friends that you didn't know you had. And I'm discovering that to be true. And I even got reminded this morning that God loves me even if my PowerPoint doesn't work. So I really hope this will be a conversation as much as me presenting. Here you notice that I have with youth in parentheses, and so much of my writing and teaching is about youth, but it's just very thinly veiled. The truth is that I write about formation for human beings. I think youth are human beings, and children as well. And so what I'm suggesting today as an imagining for youth could very easily be a way of imagining for an ecology of formation for children or for adults. So that's why the parentheses. If you don't mind. Before I show my own proposal, I want to remind you of, and you've been reminded several times already, of the traditional, and I don't mean traditional like patristic model, but the 20th century, mid-20th century into the present, the model for moat that has been predominantly operative for youth ministry. And that is what has been facetiously called the one-eared Mickey Mouse. And in this, you can see it here, that youth ministry becomes its own entity. It's like Shanna described yesterday. You hire a youth worker, and you get a bus, and and then you take the kids off into that place, and they exist there, sometimes literally at the edge of the church parking lot, you know, in the double wide or single wide or the old cottage that nobody knocked down when they built the parking lot. And the covenant is that the two shall never meet. Okay? Everything's great. You can show up occasionally, like if they get confirmed, or the annual youth worship Sunday. That'd be another time when they can appear. But otherwise, we'd appreciate it if you'd stay outside and let us do our thing. Okay, and so this is an example of another kind of uncritical importation from Babylon or Rome or whatever empire you want to pick up on, in that the church has accepted largely the notion of demographic separation. Okay? It's right and proper and good. It is meet and right, so to do, that youth should be over here, children should be over here, and adults should be over here. In this case, we're just mirroring the kind of separation of the wider culture. It hasn't always been this way. It didn't fall out of heaven, but ever more young people are, frankly, ghettoized. They are placed in... They are dismembered and left to kind of raise themselves without the benefits of wisdom of their elders and without any sense of really calling to care for their youngers. So this is problematic, and I just love this line. I think it captures so much about youth ministry, the trailer. Go ahead. So I'm going to propose... a different kind of model, and I am so proud of my PowerPoint. I mean, I spent hours putting these circles together and shading them and making them overlap. And my son is a graduate student down south Chicago, and he said, "Dad, you know, I could have done this for you in about 10 minutes, and you would have been free to think." No, this is part of it. It's not just the medium. So I hear I've created anticipation in you by not filling these in. And I want to, of course, in counterpoint to the traditional model, I want to find ways to bring people back together, and especially folks in congregations who are often marginalized, the very young, the very old. I want to find ways to bring them back together, and I want to also, and you'll notice that there's a lot of liturgical like language in this. Would you mind going backwards just for a second, because I forgot something? So a brief history of the evolution of this model. Once upon a time, it wasn't this way. Congregations worshipped and gathered intergenerationally, right? And so some funny things happened in the 20th century, and there are any number of causes, but if we just limit ourselves to, say, the 60s or the 70s forward, at least in my own tradition, the United Methodist tradition, we found ourselves besieged by all the movements for civil rights, for women's rights, and as church people, our denomination was deeply concerned about these things. And frankly, it was a crisis of sorts that consumed so much of the denomination's energy that we, in fact, took our eyes off the ball with respect to our practices of forming faith in children and youth. So we lost focus. That was one thing that went on. In addition, at some point, the powers that be in Nashville decided that it was no longer appropriate for the church to be run like a federation. It was at that time, educationally and formationally, it was very top down. There was an agency in Nashville that each year was overseeing the curriculum that was to be distributed to all the churches, and it was making certain that the camping ministries were correlated with that curriculum, and that those things were also correlated with the church's annual focus. Hi.
Hello.
I'm sorry, we don't have chairs. We have one chair, and perhaps...
I'm just fine.
Okay. Okay. I don't know where to tell you to go. There's a chair over here if someone would like it. Come on in. So we're just, for those who are just walking in, we're talking about recent past practices of youth ministry. And we have talked about this model in which the tacit agreement is that the youth ministry goes on apart from the life of the congregation. And I'm giving a number of reasons right now for why that's the case. Okay, so, get back. So there was this crisis that the church and all mainline churches dealt with of how do we come to terms with this emergence of understanding the need for liberation for people of color, for women and such. And that diverted attention from faith formation. Second, there was once upon a time a centralized bureaucracy that made certain that there was tight thematic coherence in all of the church's educational and formational efforts. So the Sunday school teachings, the camping ministries, the missional efforts, they were all interwoven in a way that they built upon one another. They helped to interpret one another. And then the denominational leadership decided, in light of this movement of people to claim their places, that the church itself was institutionally too hierarchical.
and it decided that it was going to allow young, it was going to allow individual congregations to shape their own efforts at faith formation, at raising children into adult disciples. So it, all that apparatus that once passed on instructions to congregations, that all went away, that dissolved. But we never forgot, we never bothered to send anybody out to equip individual congregations to take responsibility for this responsibility we had just handed over. And so the result was a nightmare. It was people just scrambling hither and yon to find materials, and into this come independent denominational curricular publishers who are motivated by profit, and so just willy-nilly we're pulling things off the shelves, and we end up with the edutainment kinds of, like, I remember a Vacation Bible School theme in the 80s from an independent curricular publisher that was titled Lava Lava Island. Okay? So, I mean, doesn't that just speak Holy Trinity? Lava Lava Island.
Come on, there's strange heartwarming going on right now.
So congregations were not equipped to take over this responsibility. They just did the best that they could. And the final result, of course, is a breakdown of any kind of ecology or formation. Some congregations were able to muster internally, either by the virtue of wealth or wisdom, the means by which to shape a congregation that was faithful to the faith tradition that they were part of. Others were too small, too out of the loop to manage that. And so we end up in the late 1900s, with teachers teaching easy-to-teach curriculum, and teachers don't know anything more than the 10 minutes they've spent looking at it than their students do about Christian faith and discipleship. So these are a number of contributors to this decline of faith formation in congregations. I would say another one, though it was certainly an unintentional consequence, was the surfacing of parachurch youth ministry movements. So all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but Young Life or Campus Crusade or whatever show up in neighborhoods and schools, and they're staffed by passionate, hipster young adults. And since the church is dead for all intents and purposes, young people are find it very easy to affiliate with parachurch ministries and just show up in their parents' churches, you know, by parental fiat. But their real sense of location is their parachurch. They're cared for there. They're people passionate about Jesus there. Well, the church sees this happening and says, "Well, we'll trump it. You know, I'll raise that parachurch ministry, and I'll hire the parachurch ministry to come into our congregation." So into the congregation comes a passionate young adult, usually with no sense about the denomination, the congregation's theological tradition, you know, no real reference point for the congregation at all. And so you have a youth minister over here who knows nothing about being Lutheran, forming the faith of young Lutheran. Okay, so these are all contributors. That's just some of my deconstruction of the traditional model. Okay, you have questions or comments about this? Any of you witnessed this sort of scenario? Okay, go ahead. This is going to be my proposal, that we find ways to bring back together what has been dismembered. Go ahead. And I'll start here with gathering. I'm going to name, you'll see, three three what I call primary practices of congregational life. And the first one that I deal with is, I'm going to deal with here, is gathering. So gathering is, before it is a congregational practice, it is, in fact, an attribute of God. It is part of the nature of God. God is a gatherer. God, in a surplus of love, an abundance of love, not out of any need for creation or for humankind, God, nevertheless, is always seeking to gather creation back into loving relationship with God. Okay? So I'm not just talking functionally here, I'm talking theologically, that gathering is something that God is, and God's a gatherer, and God is about gathering. But I think about this in terms of congregations, primarily around the practices of worship. Okay, there are many ways that congregations gather, but the primary way we gather is in and through worship. And this is also theologically appropriate. If the community has a sense that all that exists, including that community, is a gift from a loving God, and that this community is continually being redeemed in and through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and that this community is being empowered to somehow participate in or lead out toward God's reign in the fullness of time, if that's what we profess, then our first response, a natural response, is doxology. It's gratitude and praise that this God is so mind-blowingly loving that God has set all this in motion. Okay, so gathering is a primary practice because it is the way that we feebly, but at times sincerely, try to give thanks to God for all that God has given us. And gathering is also, just a step back, gathering is also critical to Jesus' ministry. Jesus is forever and always gathering. He's gathering especially those who have not had a place prior, have not had a place at the table. So thinking about this gathering, I tend to think of this, you can advance the slide just for something else to look at. I'm going to say a few things about worship. I think of it as a ritual symbolic participation in holy things. This is a phrase from a liturgical theologian. And these holy things include the bath, that is baptism, the table, the Eucharistic table, our book of stories of God's salvation, the scriptures, and also into distinctive temporal rhythms, the patterning of time. Okay, book bath table time is the name of a book I wrote a while back, and people just call it Bed Bath and Beyond. I had a great title thought up, and the editor said, "Would you want people to read it?" And so it became Book Bath Table. So these are holy things in the sense that they are ordinary things, ordinary human things, or ordinary things with which human beings interact. We are storytellers. We need to eat. We need to wash, to be renewed. You know, all of these are ordinary things. The way we keep time is a very earthly, material thing. And yet, by God's grace, they can convey extraordinary grace, even transforming grace. And I would say that book, bath, table, and time are interdependent. All right? More ecological language. That there's a way that the bath enacts a reality that words can't quite describe. I mean, to be claimed by God and incorporated into Christ's body. Paul says, He says, you know, we're not baptized because Jesus was baptized or like Jesus was baptized. We're baptized into the death and hope of resurrection. There's a way, So there's a way that the bath enacts a reality that words can't fully grasp. And yet, the words, particularly the words from the scriptures, are incredibly important for us unpacking this gift. So I think, was it Deborah this morning, talked about how omnipresent water is in the salvation story. Water's there from before the beginning, and water is there at the promised end with the river of the waters of life flowing through the heavenly city. A liturgical theologian describes this as water flowing like a fugal theme through the salvation narrative. So the words of the stories help us generate even further sensibilities about the bath. That, yes, it's a washing, but it's also a crossing of the Red Sea from slavery into freedom. It's crossing Jordan to inherit the promised land. So the stories help us interpret and know more about the bath than we would know if all we had was the bath. On the opposite side, there's something about the bath. I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Jeff.
Jeff, and your son's name is James. Jeff said that nowadays when baptisms take place in his congregation, he finds himself weeping because he senses what he did not all the time know, but senses the power of what's going on here. God's in the room. Yeah. So book, bath, table, time are interdependent with one another. They help interpret one another. And ecologically speaking, if you were to remove one of them, like I told my table group this morning, I grew up in a South Georgia church with a beloved pastor, lasted forever, I mean way longer than Methodist pastors usually stick around, and his practice was to baptize infants in the home of the family. So my experience of baptism growing up as a child and then as an adolescent was it was a null curriculum. It was absent. There was no baptism practice in the worshiping congregation. So a piece of the ecology gets yanked out, and what happens? The whole thing gets weakened. The possibilities for claiming the gift of Christian identity are limited. So I see this book, Bath, Table, and Time, as importantly interconnected. All right.
Also, like with Eucharist, right, being removed from weekly worship.
Yeah, yeah, so absolutely.
Grand jury, it happens behind closed doors.
Yeah, well, you know, we Methodists, I can diss my own people. We still think that pastor is the sort of czar with respect to worship, and we don't have a worship book the way the more liturgical leaning faith communities do. All right, so. Some more things about this gathering. I think the gathering is necessarily incarnational in the sense that these are, again, we play with ordinary human material reality, and yet the invitation is to encounter holy mystery through them. This gathering is a place for graced exchange. So we show up with our piddling little offerings to the triune God. God receives them, transforms them, and gives them back to us. God pays it forward in worship. It's our job to show up and give praise. And it turns out that God gives us grace and power to continue the journey in and through worship. So it is this uneven transaction, a blessed, graceful transaction of grace. I would say another dimension of this gathering is that it is an imaginative proposal and a performance of Christian life. So it's both a kind of stylized performance of how the church is to live, but it's also an authentic and real one. So I'm associated with the Youth Academy, and in a recent gathering, one of the very first nights, we had communal worship, and we were a very diverse body. We are not all United Methodists. We're from all over the place. And one of the very first nights at worship, I'll call him Pete Pentecost, and he was worshiping in the way in which his faith community had taught him to worship. And so his hands were lifted, and he was praising God, he was amening. You know, you understand this. And he was caught up in the Spirit. Well, across the aisle was Aaron the Anglican, okay? Aaron the angry Anglican. And in the middle of the service, Aaron gets up, crosses the aisle, and calls out Pete and says, you know, get it under control. Be respectful. This is worship. Okay, you can imagine that Pete was baffled, to say the least, but you know, essentially humiliated publicly. Fortunately, the Youth Academy at that time, we had 2 weeks to try to get this right. So over those 2 weeks' time, young people who attend study worship, the theology of worship, and including the theology of passing the peace and confessing of sin and the possibilities of reconciliation. And on one of the last nights of the Youth Academy, at the time for the confession of sin, then the passing of peace, Aaron got up, went across the aisle, and confessed his sin to Pete, and in the middle of worship, okay, and said how wrong he was and begged Pete's forgiveness, which blessedly was granted, and then there was a hug and release. We don't do extended hugs at the Youth Academy. the point here is that for Aaron, it did not occur to Aaron that this is some kind of space where we pretend about realities that we actually do somewhere else, but that worship was a place of authentic Christian life, and this reconciliation was an authentic reconciliation. He could have done it, you know, during a goldfish break, but he did it in the midst of worship because it just seemed like that was the place to do it. That was quite wow. Beautiful. So that's another dimension of this gathering I want to highlight. And then, of course, it's guided by a number of norms linked to the notion of God as gatherer. And I think I'll skip those just for the sake of time. But I would say one more thing about the gathering is that its intent, by virtue of the baptismal reality of Jesus relativizing all of our differences in light of the unity we share in him, its intent is to be fully inclusive of all kinds of people. It's back to the notion of the gathering God. And perhaps one of the most egregious sins the North American church has committed is the fact that we have let that, we haven't bothered to notice that injunction. You know, we have decided that it's okay to let differences that Paul says are irrelevant divide us in our worship. Okay, thanks, go ahead. So another set of primary practices that are, I think, key involve sending. I have to find my notes. Un momento. And they're all over the place. Well, I'll just wing it. So sending is a reciprocal relationship with gathering, and so the church, it turns out, is a sent people. Okay, And that's because God is a gatherer. God is a missionary. And we the church, are people who gather to be empowered. We gather to praise, but also to be empowered to do the work of God's sending. God sends the church out into the world to welcome and gather everyone who's not yet been made welcome into the fold. God is a missionary. So mission isn't something that, you know, isn't a program that we design. It isn't first a program that we design, and it isn't a trip. It is part of the nature of God, and for those of us who are baptized into this triune God, it is therefore part of the nature of the church. The church is a sent body. At my table, this morning we talked about a theme that didn't get raised in the larger assembly, at least while I was there, the theme of baptism as commissioning and empowerment for ministry. This, you know, it's clearly the thing that happened, one of the things that happened to Jesus in his baptism was that he was empowered to take up this ministry that God the Father had in mind for him. So we too are sent. We're sent and we have become the hands and feet of Jesus, sent to carry on his ministry, to point to the reign of God and to enact it as best we can. So we are a sent people. This is of course I love the kind of correspondence between the missional language and the liturgical language. So we gather and we're sent from worship. But our sending of course always winds up back here in our gathering. So there's a rhythmic and expansive cycle. Yeah. Okay. Forgot the cool sending pictures. All right, go ahead. And there are also congregational practices of forming in one way or another, having to do with equipping the congregation for gathering and equipping the congregation for its missional sending role. I'm going to come over here now because I need to look at some of my notes. Thank you. Forming is also first an attribute of God. In one of the Genesis accounts, at least, we get this notion of God, the implication of God as an artist, as a potter who shapes the human beings as out of clay and breathes the spirit into them. And it shows up explicitly in Isaiah when the prophet references God as a potter who can shatter the pots into clay shards. Is that the word? Shards of clay. Not to be confused with jars of clay. I'm stuck on, help me out of this. Into pieces, and then can remake them. Sorry?
Yes, remake.
Thank you. With the help of water, which of course the early church seized upon in its genius as a kind of baptismal, anticipatory baptismal image. So God is a forming God. It's the nature of God to create, and of course, this experiment falls at a certain level, but through baptism into Christ and by firing these newly remade pots in the kiln of the Holy Spirit, by grace, we human beings may be reformed, recreated. So formation is an attribute of God, which turns into a set of practices for the church as well. And I think these three are primary in this ecology. And just as it was the case with Book Baptismal Time in the gathering, that if you were to excise one of these, you know, always gathering but never sending, always going but never gathering, or gathering and sending but never talking about what any of that means, that weakens the overall ecology. So a question that pastors and youth leaders and such could ask themselves, perhaps profitably, is, you know, which of these constellations of practices are we, you know, are we making an A in, and which perhaps are less privileged?
Are you looking at forming as more discipleship and raising up those who have were the result of ascending, and the gathering just more worshiping, sending, gathering people together, and then forming them in discipleship? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I'm going to do incredible things with these circles in just a moment. that will astound you. And we'll see how forming... And what I think it'll help clarify what you're seeking to know. So why don't we go there now? I always forget to show my illustrations. So these are DYA kids in the process of being formed. And you see how effective it is.
It just
consumes their every breath. Yeah. Okay. So here we go. What I want you to know is, at least this is what I think, that gathering is also forming. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That this is the notion that there are Boku folks out there right now writing about how human beings are not just neck up machine, you know, we're computers with unfortunate appendices. But instead we are fully embodied beings. And so worship is a space where we learn perhaps to lift our hands in praise, or to kneel or prostrate ourselves in humility or repentance. And those kinds of practices, those bodily practices, in association with the stories of God, become dispositional. They become... habitual, that we are people who are people no matter the circumstances, who are yet able to praise. We are people who are never forgetful of the woundedness of ourselves and others. So by going through the motions of the liturgy, by enacting the saving stories of God, they are internalized. They become part of how not only we see the world, but how we habitually respond. If the assembly is sufficiently full of enough different kind of folks, it can teach us to regard difference not as a threat, but as a gift. If I pass the peace only with people who look like me, liturgy can malform us. But when the church manages to get it right, DYA is one small case in point. DYA is not the church. I'm speaking of the youth academy that is incredibly diverse. That is, for many of our kids, that's the first ever encounter, significant bodily encounter with people who are different than they are. Okay? And I think that alone is formative. All right? In the same way, sending is formative. Kids on a mission trip come home different. They are often surprised. For example, they imagine that they're taking Jesus with them to give to the unenlightened, and then they discover that Jesus is already there. And so, and of course, in the sending, we have a primary opportunity to encounter cultural difference, all the ways, all the pluralities of possibilities that God has created people. Encounters with difference open space for transformation. They can cause us to see, oh my gosh, you know, not everybody has as nice a toilet paper as we have here in America. Not everybody here feels the need to live in a single family residence. So there's space to encounter difference, and we know from our own stories of the scriptures that encountering difference is often the same as encountering Christ. Okay? The guest who becomes the host. So there are opportunities in the sending to discover and practice compassion, vulnerability, humility, reception of the gift of the other. So sending all by itself can be formative. But then it turns out that forming is also formational. There are places and spaces for intentional formation that are not just part of the enculturation of gathering and sending. So places where we set out to learn the saving stories of God, to learn the scriptures, spaces where we try to understand what these mean, what these stories mean about God's continuing relationship with us. We do theology. There are spaces for us in formation and its own little space to prepare for our gathering, to learn how to consider what it means to gather for worship and get some preparatory work before we go gather. Equally, there are spaces for reflecting upon our gatherings and our sendings. I mean, these things can be train wrecks without that kind of space for formation. It's possible to send kids on a mission trip and have them come back saying, "Thank God I'm an American, and I don't have to live like all those poor people." My wife is a nurse practitioner and went as part of a medical mission group from our congregation. This was back in the day. And she went with dentists and nurses and doctors, and they all go. There was no one with any sort of theological, not that this is an essential requirement, but there were no trained theologians along, okay? And so they would finish these exhausting days in which they encountered face-to-face, what poverty reaps, and in terms of health or lack thereof. And they would go back to their building and they would talk about, "Man, that was a hard day." Nobody to ask them, "Where did you encounter God in this space? How does this experience shake up what you thought you believed? What gifts surprised you when you thought you were bringing them?" You know, there was nobody to ask those kinds of questions, nobody to invite the group to dig into the scriptures. There were many good things done, but as an episode of Christian formation, I'm sure that again the sending was forming, but it could have been so much more. Okay. What else do I want to say about this? Well, and here I need to stop so that you can talk, but I would add to this, so there are different kinds of forming, and there is sort of critical, reflective forming that I just described, but there's also the forming that invites us to take the images, the metaphors, the ritual symbols that we play with, and help them to thicken and come alive. So we discover, if we're doing formation around the gathering, that we're invited to reflect on how the baptismal waters they're essential for life, but they also bring death. How they transport us from our bondage to sin, our slavery to sin, towards the new creation, the promised land. How these waters are both a source of peace and sustaining, but and also of terror. I mean, it's terrifying when those of you who were baptized, not just by getting a few drops, but you get held under that water for just a little bit longer than you feel is necessary, and finitude comes into your mind, right? So to reflect on the breadth and power of the ritual symbol is a way then to go back to the gathering with a deepened sense of what God is doing in the midst. So there are times to do forming apart from, maybe always with an eye to, but apart from the practices of gathering and sending. Okay, so that's my spiel. Do you have questions or comments? Things? Yeah, sure.
So give us some pictures or help us understand with that center circle with forming, yes, how the one-eared Mickey Mouse doesn't fit in the middle of that, right? So, you know, we know that youth in many, many churches are present in worship and they're being sent in various ways, and some of those are intergenerational, but then can you give us some pictures of what that formation looks like without the ghettoization of the young people?
Sure. Well, I guess I just sort of assume this without pointing it out, that so young people are in all of these all of these practicing ecologies. Okay, so when we gather, we all gather, and in that sense, so we look. Young people learn how to worship not by taking a class, but by watching those who already know, and learn how to serve in the same way. The formational part, I think, is partly it's, again, that young people need to receive the gifts of wisdom that their elders bear, or potentially bear, and elders need to receive the gifts of passion and energy and hope that young people bring with them. So when we disperse into age level Sunday school, I'm not an extremist. I understand the place of development in education, but when we make segregation the norm, then those kinds of transactions don't get made.
So what does non-segregated forming look like?
It looks like vacation Bible school for the whole church. It looks like, so I was in a congregation, I was working my way through graduate school, and one summer I served a 150 member Methodist congregation. And this was their vision, that if they could get a youth worker in for the summer, he could generate some momentum, all right, and bring in a couple, three more families. And with that many more families, they would have enough money to pay a part-time youth worker, which they could then grow the youth ministry further. And then what they wanted to do? Get a bus. That was their vision. And I come into this congregation, and I notice that the youth are singing in the adult choir. I mean, that all kinds of people are in the choir. I see vacation Bible school, where some of the activities are distributed by age, but other of the activities include everyone around the tables. That's what it looks like for me, Jim.
Our addition, we have intergenerational worship. We have structures for intergenerational discipleship learning together. And in the sending, I'm trying to imagine what that structure could look like. Like at the end of the worship service, or just pure, we are reminded that we're sent to our neighborhoods, our schools, our workplaces, where we are sent. But our youth spend a lot of time in that, in public schools. They're out there. Even if they have an identity of being sent, they're out there a lot of times on their own. It's kind of a rough place, and I'm just trying to imagine. Sure, it'd be great to have an adult with them, maybe, I don't know, but I'm having more difficulty trying to imagine what kinds of regular patterns or structures that embody the things set together.
Well, it's I do not uncritically endorse mission trips, but I am still on the side of the equation that thinks that they can be under the right circumstances, the right preparation, and with the right kind of spirit, they can be redemptive. And I would say that that is a space where the sending can be intergenerational. I mean, in my part of the country, Appalachian Service Project is a long-standing tradition for many congregations, and the ratio of adults to young people is in the congregations I've seen, it's about 50-50. So there is that possibility, but there's also just that this is just sort of the reality. You know, there's a formation that can take place. This is Brueggemann language behind the wall, and that would hopefully be inclusive of the wisdom of elders and the passion of youth. But at some point, we have to emerge from behind the wall and either stand on the wall and face the public or cross the wall into the public. And we hope that even though that world isn't ideal, that we take what we've gotten from behind the wall with us. Yes, sir?
Kind of along that lines, pretty small rural congregation. So I've got a 12-year-old who is heading off to middle school. Pretty much, you know, as a Christian by herself. She doesn't have a youth group that's going to middle school with her. At the same time, we are very much relying on the intergenerational support to be there. But I'd love to hear, I guess my question, well, and the other piece of this that makes it a challenge is the fragmented church that if you go to the, you know, the big church that's got the 100-member youth group, you're kind of in the rich, you're in a different group than the little church that doesn't really have this. So I'd like to hear a little more about, I guess, the intergenerational formation, and because we're kind of needing that in a lot of ways, and particularly with the spectacle we were hearing about, that this whole image stuff is. I hate to shock the group here, but we had a young woman half a mile from us 2 years ago, 14 years ago, hung herself over the body image. This is serious business. I know we all know that, but you know that I don't look like a Abercrombie and Fitch model is worth dying for. That's incredible. So I just, anything to help us kind of push, where does Jesus bring love into our lives in a place that, you know, if you're not perfect, I guess there's a question in there somewhere.
Well, you're the pastor with the hard job, and I'm the, you know, I'm the academic who gets to tell people what to do, and tell people what to read, and so I happen to have written an article about rural church youth ministry, and so it doesn't really address the particulars of this young woman's circumstance, but I think that in some ways, smaller congregations are in a better place to call upon the gifts of their young members and to rely upon them to share in the ministry of the congregation. In the small churches I've visited in North Carolina, that's where I live, the teenage, forgive the sexist distribution of labor here, but the teenage boys spend the night out at the barbecue pit with the men, spitting and telling stories, while the
while the pig's being roasted, because they need the boys to help lift pig parts and such.
And the young women are the next day helping to put the barbecue
coleslaw.
Plate and the coleslaw and all that into the styrofoam container. it's we need you. I mean, this body will not be as healthy as it could be without you. So there's, I think, almost a predisposition, or at least there's nowhere to hide in a small congregation. So what may seem like a lack, this is what I told this congregation that I summered with. I said, you people are aspiring for a model of youth ministry. You already have a vital model of youth ministry. Your young people are intimately part of the gathering and the sending and the forming. All of the adults of the congregation knew these kids by name. So they already had this incredibly healthy formative culture, this healthy youth ministry. So even if she's just one, and I know that I haven't talked at all about Babylon or Rome or North America, whatever. I know it's hard, but there are still reasons for us to be hopeful, and you especially.
Well, in a sense, do you think that, like, always talking about, oh, I wish our church could reach more youth, I wish we could have a youth group, I wish we could do it, like, in a sense, is belittling the ministry that's going on, and, like, always saying, like, well, we just fail in this kind of thing. I feel like it kind of is beating themselves up. In a sense, and even I'm in a university setting, and so we have lots of college students, grad students, and tiny children, and no youth. And people are always lamenting why we don't have any youth. Da 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 da. And I'm like, but we have all these tiny children. Like, that's just where our focus should be, and raise them. They're going to be youth, and they won't leave us, you know, at confirmation when they graduate. And we kind of like it. So.
And it's helpful just to remember that it's God who's the missionary. One of the missional theologians just talks about it this way, that God has a mission, and that mission involves a church. So the church is not the primary architect of mission. It's God who has a mission. And so the church just needs to continue to discern how to get alongside of what God is already doing, and expect with faith and hope that God is, in fact, doing things. So, yeah. Yes, sir.
Would you say that, I mean, in light of this, a very important practice with regards to some of these issues, kind of a smaller church being self-conscious about not looking like the big programs or whatever, or a very unique situation of having one cross-section of youth but not having another age group of youth, but just simply the practice of praising certain... certain interactions, whether it's a sort of a more integrated church, just constantly noting it and praising it,
mm-hmm.
Is deeply formative. Because if that's not being praised, and we just let the sort of church marketing publishing companies say, with the images, by just publishing images of vibrant youth ministries are ones that have all the smoke machines and glamour. I mean, that's what's being praised just by virtue of the images, you know, and just the practice of finding creative ways to celebrate,
yes.
name and praise it. Is
yes, I'm so with you, and that includes discovering how to see the activity of God in what seems otherwise very ordinary.
Right.
Henry Nouwen. Was it Morgan? He told us part of the story yesterday. So Henry Nouwen discovers, he thinks that caring for a severely disabled man is going to get in the way of his vocation to be a scholarly superstar. And he discovers in getting Adam out of bed, toileted, dressed to the breakfast table and feeding him, he discovers the depth of kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one of the errors I think we are prone to, not you all, is this need to look for the extraordinary all the time. Like, you know,
out on my head, and a stranger showed up and grabbed me and pulled me away and pushed the building back up. God be praised. But instead, that you know, it's like our gathering. I mean, we share a pool. We bathe together. We share a table together. It's ordinary stuff, but it's tremendous mystery. Yes.
Just two things anecdotally. I went to go to my first cousin's licensing in Pennsylvania. The worship leader was 16 years old, and the Sunday school superintendent was 15. And I said, "What is this? It's like youth Sunday or something like that?" He says, "No, that's your job. That's what you do here every Sunday." And I just think that it's important in terms of integrating or putting the labels of intergenerational. It's not even second thought. It's a job available. You do it. You're going to be trained by walking alongside this person, and then we're going to take our hands off of it, and we're going to do something else, and that's your responsibility.
Yeah. One of the hallmarks of the church that Jeremiah Wright formerly served was that youth were integral to the formation of children. Mm-hmm. Youth led the children's choir that sung every fifth Sunday in worship. The youth taught the young children how. Sorry, how to do this.
I don't know.
And
it's a gene.
I mean, honestly, I don't think it is. Because these children needed to learn, and they were yelling out to shape up. But so this is this notion of the baptized, the ministry of the mission, the sending belonging to all of the baptized. I know we're at time. I feel we're past time, actually. I feel obligated. I'll be glad to talk to you after.
Sure.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.